We'll touch a little bit on global trade today. We'll take a detour to early childhood education and end by talking to Ben Carson about how he would run the American economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From San Francisco, today, the studios of KQED, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, the 7th day of October. Glad, as always, that you could be with us, everybody. We're going to pick up today with our coverage of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, it's called. That ginormous trade deal that wrapped up negotiations earlier this week. 12 countries, 40% of the global economy. Yeah, that one. You've heard of it before. If you heard the program yesterday, you heard President Obama, as he starts his sales pitch to Congress and to the rest of us, say this to me.
We will strengthen the hand of reformers inside of China.
So it's worth a reminder here that China is not actually in the TPP, so you can take that with a White House-sized grain of salt. But in some TPP countries, domestic reform is actually on the agenda. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson gets us going.
It's easy to think the TPP is all about trade, how much sugar, dairy one country can sell to another. But trade agreements can also be about changes countries may want to make for themselves.
These kinds of trade liberalization efforts are not just drivers of reform. In many cases, they are the actual reforms themselves.
Nick Consonari is with the Eurasia Group. He says, look at Japan. As his colleague Scott Seaman explains, Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has been pushing a package of reforms. For one, he'd like to tackle protections and subsidies for Japanese farmers.
To get them to really kind of pull themselves up by their own bootstraps and refocus their attention on growing the sorts of things that can be very profitable, not only inside Japan, but also in external markets.
Peter Petrie, a professor at Brandeis, says trade deals can give politicians some distance from reforms that may cause pain at home.
The Japanese call this gaiatsu. It's when you use foreign pressure to do the things that you know you have to do, but are politically very difficult.
Vietnamese officials also say they want to use TPP to push domestic reforms, says Derek Scissors with the American Enterprise Institute, like limiting support for state-owned enterprises.
And if they say this is an unmatched opportunity for us to be able to export to the U.S. and Japan and other TPP members, and you got to bite the bullet, it gives them a reason to drive those reforms over domestic opposition.
But Scissors cautions, we can't say how much change the TPP might spur until we know more about the terms that were agreed to this week. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Take a listen to all of what the president had to say to us yesterday. Our whole interview is online at marketplace.org. Also, tomorrow on the program, the flip side of the pro-TPP coin. It's worth a mention, too, that late this afternoon, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton told the PBS NewsHour that she is opposed to the global trade deal. She is, of course, running for her old boss's job. All right, so let's take a quick pivot here from big picture global trade to corporate specific global trade. All right, this morning Monsanto reported a $500 million quarterly loss, and as a result, is going to cut about 2,600 jobs. The company is, as you know, a giant in the world of genetically modified seeds and herbicides, but demonstrating once again that bigger is not always better, Monsanto is still captive to a global slump in commodity prices. Marketplace's Annie Baxter follows that news through the U.S. food chain.
If you don't pay a lot of attention to corn and soybean prices, the idea that Midwestern farmers are seeing bumper crops this year might sound like good news. But Jason Ward with North Star Commodity says problem is the global market's already awash in corn and soybeans.
We've got too much of something that's too expensive, and it just needs to be cheap for a while to kind of grind through it.
Over the past few years, demand for ethanol and livestock feed pushed prices up, according to economist Bruce Babcock at Iowa State University. That goosed sales at companies like Monsanto.
When those prices were rising, farmers could afford to pay a lot for their inputs, their seed, their fertilizer, their chemicals. Monsanto, like all other agricultural input suppliers, raised their prices.
But Babcock says corn and soybean prices have come down nearly 50% from their peak. They're below the break-even point for farmers. Babcock says it's not surprising Monsanto's sales are dropping, too. Many farmers can't afford all those seeds and fertilizers today.
We may be in a situation where we might lose $200,000 to $300,000 this year.
Soybean farmer Teresa Gilley in Minnesota is looking for ways to cut costs. She says that might mean ditching Monsanto's genetically modified seeds in favor of traditional hybrids, which are cheaper. Or, she says, farmers might push Monsanto for lower prices.
I gotta tell you, I don't think there is a farmer out there that isn't going to look for any angle they can cut.
No matter what, she says, it's going to be a skinny year for a lot of people in agriculture, from big Monsanto down to the small farmers. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Monsanto shares had a little bump on news of those layoffs. Major indices ticked up a bit as well. Today, we will have the details when we do the numbers. You got your booms, you got your busts, and then you've got your long, slow, painful declines. The American steel industry comes to mind. Detroit and cars, too. Also, coal. In federal bankruptcy court this week, Patriot Coal said it's going to close plants and lay off as many as 2,000 people. But there is something new and different going on with coal. Among those seeking to scoop up distressed mining assets is an environmentalist whose plan is to keep the mines open, but to plant millions of trees and thus offset the coal's carbon emissions. Marketplace's Scott Tong from the Sustainability Desk has our story.
This may be a first, planting trees while mining coal. It strikes some as the equivalent of low-tar cigarettes or perhaps healthy cheesecake. But the man behind this, Tom Clark, says he wants to be controversial. Clark runs a healthcare company and an environmental nonprofit in Virginia.
We've got about 3.1 trillion trees, and it's estimated that when human civilization began, we had about 5.6 trillion. So we need to almost double the number of trees. We think this is an economic model that can actually move the needle closer to that number.
Here's the model. Clark wants to acquire, via bankruptcy, a West Virginia coal mine whose product is environmentally unfriendly, and then put in a forest on site that is friendly and sell it as a package.
Our thought is that we'll be able to sell coal that actually has bundled with it an offset to the carbon emission profile.
Offset means reducing, actually taking greenhouse gases and absorbing, sucking them out of the atmosphere.
It's really a substantial offset. The only one that's bigger is the oceans.
Malcolm North is an ecologist with the U.S. Forest Service in Davis, California.
If you think about the main part of the tree, which is the stem or the bole, about 50% of that is actually carbon. So if you think about some of the largest trees we have, it's quite a bit of carbon.
Carbon stored for a long time, as in 3,000 years in the case of giant sequoias. To advocates of adding and replacing forests, the climate challenge is not just about reducing the greenhouse gases we put up there, but also vacuuming them out. Toby Jansen-Smith works for Verified Carbon Standard, a group that sets standards for carbon credits.
Even reducing future emissions is not going to do the job of creating a stable climate. So we're going to have to draw down and sequester what's already in the atmosphere. And that's where trees in particular become particularly compelling.
But the idea of trees plus mines has challenges. It's hard to plant near mines where the soil is polluted. And it's unclear who would buy this greener coal. Again, Tom Clark.
I guess we're sort of betting the farm that we're going to create a market.
The idea is to sell power plants the coal, along with the green credits from the trees. That shrinks the power company's carbon footprints, which the EPA is forcing them to do. The thing is, the EPA does not accept forest planting as a way to do that.
This won't stop us. I mean, if something happens that we hadn't anticipated, we'll be right on to the next opportunity to sell compliant fuel.
And the way things are going, there will be more bankrupt mines available for cheap. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Not that this is in any way, shape, or form surprising, but Volkswagen made it official today. The biggest recall in that company's history is going to start in January. Somewhere in the neighborhood of 11 million cars worldwide are involved in the diesel emissions scandal that we've all heard so much about. Some of them will just need new software, some a change in hardware. Here in the U.S., the EPA is going to have to weigh in, but either way that goes, it's going to cost VW a boatload of money, as Marketplace's Noelle King reports.
When a car company launches a recall, they have to pay for everything. Train technicians to fix the problem, customer outreach to let people know what's happening, shipping and storing new parts, lawyers and PR and crisis management people.
There are massive dollars involved in this.
That's Jack Nerad, executive editorial director at Kelley Blue Book. He says right now it's impossible to tell how much this will cost.
once you actually have service for tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, and globally millions of customers, that becomes very, very expensive.
But this is a different type of recall. This isn't a case where airbags are defective or cars are catching fire. David Cole is chairman of Auto Harvest, an internet marketplace. He says a fix could actually reduce the car's power and fuel economy, and customers might not want that.
It'll be very interesting to see how many people take them up on that offer.
If they don't, that could make Volkswagen's bill a little cheaper. But either way, Volkswagen has reportedly said that the $7.3 billion it initially set aside to fix the problem won't be enough. The biggest cost over time could be to Volkswagen's reputation. That's equally hard to measure because it comes down to whether individual consumers are willing to forgive the company. Jonathan Banks is VP of Vehicle Analysis at NADA Used Car Guide.
How does this make me feel about the Volkswagen brand? And will that drive me to purchase another vehicle, or will I remain loyal?
Volkswagen will likely try to make the recall as painless as possible for customers so it can try to regain some of that loyalty. I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
Coming up,
I don't think anybody objects to paying taxes if they thought that it was being used efficiently.
Aye, there's the rub. Ben Carson on his economic platform coming up. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 122 points today, 0.7%, finished at 16,912. The NASDAQ added 42 points, about 0.9%, 4791. The S&P 500 up 15 points, 0.8%, closed at 1995. Yum! Brands off 18% after reporting that sales in China recovered less than expected. KFCs and Pizza Huts in China produce more than half of Yum's sales. The worry for investors, their future sales growth, of course. GoPro slid after Morgan Stanley panned prospects for its tiny new camera, smaller but not necessarily better. The concern is whether that company can keep up with competition. Shares down 4.3% today, and you are listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. It seems like a no-brainer that sending kids from low-income families to preschool early when they're 4 years old would give them a boost in school later on. But researchers looking at a big state-funded pre-kindergarten program in Tennessee have been left shaking their heads because professors at Vanderbilt University found some children who go to pre-K start falling behind those who don't go. Blake Farmer reports from WPLN in Nashville.
Pre-K is for learning how to hold a pencil and starting to recognize words. And, of course, messing with Play-Doh.
Look what I made, silly boys.
A girl with a bright yellow polo shirt shows off her creation to the boys at her table. The question is whether this extra year at Nashville's Ross Early Learning Center is worth the time and money. There's been a stack of research from Boston to Tulsa, Oklahoma that says it is. But that's not what Vanderbilt's Dale Farron found, at least in Tennessee, and it kills her to put this out there.
We will be criticized, crucified, possibly.
Tennessee is one of several states experimenting with pre-K in a big way. For the last decade, the state has paid for 18,000 children from low-income families to get the jump start. Some want that opportunity for everyone. Others call pre-K a waste. And the Vanderbilt study gives the critics new ammo. Mark Lipsey, who also worked on the study, explains that on the whole, students who attended pre-K began to lag those who sat out.
The stunning part is that we had no real basis for expecting that the kids who had not been in pre-K into second and third grade would actually start performing somewhat better, not hugely better, but somewhat better than the kids who had been in pre-K.
This is worth repeating. By third grade, the children who didn't go to pre-K started outperforming those who did. All the students came from economically disadvantaged households, and their parents all wanted them to go to pre-K. There just wasn't enough space. Farron, the professor at Vanderbilt's education school, now feels obliged to study further and find out why. Her first hunch is a little glimmer at the end of first grade. The pre-K students were measurably less excited about school.
I wonder if part of what happened is if pre-K doesn't have a better vision for itself than trying to be a junior kindergarten, if by the end of first, children just sort of had it, you know, they've kind of had the same thing 3 years in a row, and it's too much.
quality is the likely culprit, Farron says, and the issue may be that they're getting too much old-school academic time drilling letters and numbers, not too little. Researchers are finding four-year-olds need instruction that looks a lot like playtime.
It has to be a balanced approach. They have to be able to get up and be able to move their bodies to learn and be actively engaged.
Dana Ekman kneels beside students playing with crayons. She directs Nashville's pre-K program and says she's learned that too much seat work is a problem.
What are you drawing over here? Tell me about your picture. What is that?
The Vanderbilt study, which began just a few years after the launch of Tennessee's pre-K program, doesn't reflect these best practices, Ekman says, so she's waiting for the next study.
When they come back and we do another research project on this and we take a look at third grade, I think that the outcome is going to be very different.
But the research is already being used to figure out if pre-K is worth the cost, especially in Tennessee. Governor Bill Haslam told reporters he still believes high-quality pre-K is valuable.
We'll take this as data to evaluate its effectiveness versus other things that we might do. Again, increasing technology, paying teachers more, other investments that we want to make in K-12 education.
Right now, Tennessee spends $86 million a year on pre-K. It may become increasingly difficult to justify such a large investment in the future. In Nashville, I'm Blake Farmer for Marketplace.
Dr. Ben Carson, currently standing second in GOP polls, has been much in the news the past couple of days for his comments about the shootings last week in Roseburg, Oregon, in which he said that he would have encouraged the people in that classroom at Umpqua Community College to have attacked the gunman en masse and, in theory, thus avoided the tragedy. Whether that'll hurt him in the next set of polls and the next GOP debate at the end of this month or help him is one of those things where we're just going to have to wait and see. We, though, talked to Carson on Monday morning about his economic platform, about what matters to him in the economic life of this country, and about how he would handle the job of being president. Here you go. You have said more than once you want to run the government as a business. You want the president to be the CEO of that business. And I wonder, other than running a medical office or sitting on corporate boards, Kellogg's and Costco, how do you know the government ought to be run like a business? How do you know the president ought to be the CEO?
Well, I know what efficiency looks like, and I know what inefficiency looks like. We have 4.1 million federal employees, and we have 645 government agencies and sub-agencies. And there's an enormous amount of inefficiency and overlap to be gotten rid of. And there are turnaround programs like Lean Six Sigma that are used out in the business world that are incredibly effective. And the American people deserve to have an efficient government. I don't think anybody objects to paying taxes if they thought that it was being used efficiently.
Okay, so let's talk about Ben Carson as president of the United States. You have said you want a balanced budget amendment. You have said the debt is a problem. It's a cancer on this society. So let me ask you a couple of questions about that. First of all, if we're going to have a balanced budget amendment, government's going to have to spend less. We're going to have to get more money. What will you not provide in the way of government services? What entitlements will you not provide as president that will help get the budget balanced? What are you not going to give the people?
Well, first of all, recognize that it's not that difficult. One of the bugaboos that has kept us from reducing government in the past is sacred cows. What I would do is, first of all, allow the government to shrink by attrition. Don't replace the people who are retiring, thousands of them each year. And number two, take every departmental head and tell them I want a 3-4% reduction. Now, anybody who tells me that there's not 3-4% fat in virtually everything that we do is fibbing to themselves.
With respect, sir, you didn't answer the question. What are you not going to do? It's easy to say trim fat. It's easy to say 3-4% reduction. But rejecting the premise of the question isn't answering the question.
What I'm not going to continue to do is supply money for everything. If you have to cut your budget by 3-4%, that automatically answers your question.
So will we stop health services for the poor? Will we stop supplemental nutrition programs? Will we stop corporate tax breaks? Will we stop the offshoring of corporate profits? Those kinds of things. What are we going to stop?
See, that's what certain people always say. And what I'm talking about is across the board, everything. You cannot convince me that there isn't any department that is completely 100% efficient and you can't find fat.
All right, so let's talk about debt then and the budget. As you know, Treasury Secretary Liu has come out in the last couple of days and said, we're going to run out of money. We're going to run out of borrowing authority on the 5th of November. Should the Congress then and the president not raise the debt limit? Should we default on our debt?
Let me put it this way. If I were the president, I would not sign an increase budget. Absolutely would not do it. They would have to find a place to cut.
To be clear, it's increasing the debt limit, not the budget. But I want to make sure I understand you. You'd let the United States default rather than raise the debt limit.
No, I would provide kind of leadership that says, get on the stick, guys, and stop messing around and cut where you need to cut, because we're not raising any spending limits, period.
This is debt that's already obligated. Would you not favor increasing the debt limit to pay the debts already incurred?
What I'm saying is what we have to do is restructure the way that we create debt. I mean, if we continue along this, where does it stop?
Assuming you win, and we have in January of 2017 President Carson, what is your government going to look like?
Well, it's going to look like something that is looking out for every segment of our society. We need to maximize the potential of every single one of our people. You know, we need to understand that education is the great divide in our nation. There's going to be a much more emphasis on educational choice. Also recognizing that if we get defense wrong, nothing else matters, because we live in a hostile world. You're going to see us concentrating on vulnerabilities. You're going to see us beef up our cyber capabilities substantially. You're going to see us respond to people who attack us in a way that they will never forget. You're going to see us get back into space. And in the future, he who controls space controls the earth. You're going to see much more proactive stance towards someone like Putin. You know, we're going to be much more active throughout the whole, Baltic Basin area, Eastern Europe. We're going to reestablish a missile defense program. We're going to have more than one or two armored brigades in that area. We're going to stand up to him every place in the Middle East. We're not going to back down. We're going to be, you know, taking a whole geopolitical strategy that is proactive and not reactive.
And just so I'm clear, you're going to do this while balancing the budget, not raising the debt, and cutting the size of the government.
Exactly.
Okay.
You know what? I got to tell you this.
Sir,
you might find it a little amazing. But, you know, throughout my life, I've been faced with people say, you can't do this. This is impossible. So that doesn't bother me when people say that.
I have a question about campaign finance and the dollar amounts that you raised in the most recent quarter reported to be about $20 million. Most of it comes from Facebook. And I wonder how you are besting Donald Trump on Facebook, besting Hillary Clinton on Facebook. What is your social media strategy? I imagine the whole political world wants to know.
Well, why would I tell them? But, you know, we just try to be open, honest, and interactive with people so they get a chance to really understand who I am. That's really been the secret to why we've been growing, why the poll numbers are getting better. You know, I don't hide. I go out there. I talk to people. They get to actually hear me. I explain things to them. Our founders said that our system and our freedom is based upon a well-informed and educated populace. And if they ever become other than that, they'll be easily led astray.
Dr. Ben Carson, thank you very much for your time, sir.
Has been a pleasure. Thank you.
You can read and hear, if you like, the whole interview I did with Ben Carson on our website. It went about 25 minutes all in. Marketplace.org, of course, is the way to do that. This final note on the way out today, which I will preface by saying that I enjoy a good piece of pumpkin pie as much as the next guy, but whatever this whole pumpkin spiced anything craze is, is just a travesty. Anyway, from the Chicago Tribune today, this item: it seems excessive rains in the Midwest have done damage to the pumpkin crop that is used to make canned pumpkin pie filling. So experts say there's going to be a shortage. Pick yours up early if you need it. Also, just because I thought this was interesting, more than 90% of the American pumpkin crop comes from within 90 miles of Peoria, Illinois. Who knew? All right, we're out of here. Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Jake Gorski, Bill Lantz, Garrett Lang, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the broadcast. Big shout out to Zach Rose for jumping on a train and engineering that Obama interview for us yesterday. We appreciate that. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow back in L.A. And oh yeah, this is APM.